Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, most of us can sit down and probably mention a couple of consequences of child maltreatment, but certainly much less appreciated is that there's a number of adverse childhood experiences that have been linked to risky health behaviors, chronic health conditions, and even early death. And it turns out that the number of these adverse health experiences that are experienced also increases the risk for these outcomes. The Matsu Health Foundation has been working on these as part of a broader effort to improve the health of the residents of the Matsu Borough. And here to discuss their efforts at child maltreatment and addressing the adverse health experiences is Dr. Melissa Kimberling. She's the director of programs, and Amy Gorn, who is the program officer for the Healthy Foundations for Families focus area. Both of them are with the Matsu Health Foundation. Melissa, welcome back, and Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For those listening who have questions or comments during the next hour or so, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our local number here in Anchorage is 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell it out as one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And finally, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Melissa, since we're going to be talking about health, I like to separate what is meant by health and healthcare for listeners. Many people may assume that they're synonymous and one really leads to the other, but that's not necessarily true.
No, not at all. In fact, there's a research has shown that really healthcare really accounts for only about 20% of a person's health status, and health behaviors count for about 30%. But other factors like social economic factors, so for example, employment, their income level, their family and social support, and education accounts for about 40% of their health status. And their physical environment, where they live and how safe they are, and their ability to get places, transportation, counts for about 10%. So really, just being able to go to the doctor just accounts for about 20% of a person's health status.
So I was listening to a podcast coming in today, and they made the same point, is that we were talking about aging and why we're aging, and we're aging because we have indoor toilets, we have access to health care, we have antibiotics, we have vaccinations. But the major problem with doing anything about it is really boils down to what we do behaviorally. And that's what I hear you saying in a sense here, that behavior, social factors, education, that combination of things is far more important to the health of a large any population of individuals.
Right, totally. And behavior is related to your social and economic status.
Exactly.
You know, if you don't have transportation, you can't do certain things that promote good health. You can't go to a health club. You can't go to a doctor.
So I guess the reason I like to talk about it is we're constantly thinking about the importance of health care when really, if you want to look at it in a big scheme, for all of us, our behaviors, our social milieu, our education have a much, much bigger impact.
Right.
We hate to keep saying the same thing, but sometimes saying it differently begins to make sense to people.
Right. And really what we're going to talk about today is about children and their health care. And a lot of that has nothing to do with them going to a doctor, but it's about the environment that they're raised in. So I think we'll touch on this later as well.
All right. So given that preamble, let's work our way up to this reason for this particular program, but I want to do that by going through from the basics about what's the foundation all about, and what's the work you've been doing to get us here today.
Sure. Well, the foundation is a co-owner of Matsu Regional Medical Center. We seat half of the governing board, and we get 35% of the profits to invest in the community to promote health. Our mission is to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Matsu. And our long-term goal is that the Mat-Su borough is the healthiest borough in the United States.
I remember when you came before, the model where you're getting part of the profits of the medical center seems unique to me. I mean, it certainly seems ideal, and I say that with the idea that I'm very skeptical all the time, and I'm skeptical of my interpretation that it's ideal. It seems like you're from the get-go, you were looking at the idea it's not all about health, it's about other things, social and milieu and education and behavior.
I think that our situation is really unique because we don't have to be putting out fires all the time. We can go back, step back, and look at the whole situation in our borough, the whole system of care for residents, and try and focus on not the crisis, but what we can do to avert the crisis. And I think that we're able to do that because of our funding from the profits of the hospital and just that we're a place-based funder, so we have a finite area that we have to serve.
Are you aware of other populations that have a similar setup?
There's a handful of these nationally. They're called conversion foundations. And so there are a number of other ones. Not in Alaska. We're the only one in Alaska.
All right. So how have you gone about meeting your mission?
Okay. So we're actually considered a nonprofit hospital in the eyes of the IRS. So we're required to do a community health needs assessment every 3 years. And the one that we did in 2013 really helped us figure out where to work. And it was actually quite surprising to us because the top five issues that we found as being priority issues for residents were all related to behavioral health. And when I say behavioral health, that I mean mental health and substance use disorders. And so number one was alcohol and substance use disorders. Number two was keeping our children safe and well cared for, so really looking at child maltreatment and youth violence. And tied for number three were suicide and depression, sexual assault and domestic violence, and access to mental health care. So we felt like we had a mandate from the community that we needed to really focus very closely on these issues. And so we developed three focus areas. One is on trying to make sure we have all the behavioral health services in the borough that we need. So that's called Healthy Minds. The second is Healthy Foundations for Families. So really looking at what we can do to support children and families and prevent child maltreatment. And the third is an area we've been working for a long time in, which is keeping seniors healthy and independent as long as possible, and that's healthy aging.
Amy, I want to get you in briefly. So you came, you've been with the Mat-Su Health Foundation for a while and moved up as the program officer. Is that right?
Well, actually, I'm relatively new to the Mat-Su Health Foundation team earlier this year, and I've been working to support adolescents and families for a long time through some of my work out in rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of developmental assets and going upstream and prevention work with our young people, and also I've had some experiences in juvenile justice, so seeing some of the situations that our young people, we see the impacts of some of the challenges. And so looking again towards this upstream effort and using this new report that the foundation has put out as really our mandate for how we address this particular focus area is a really exciting way of approaching and looking at it.
There have been, this is the third that what we hope to talk about today or plan to talk about. There have been two other reports. Perhaps this is a good time to talk about the results or the important parts of those previous reports.
Sure. So we started with looking at the services that we have for people for our residents as far as when they have behavioral health crisis. So we went to our hospital and we looked at the behavioral health patients who were being seen in the emergency department. And you could hypothesize that those people are not getting their needs met in the community, many of them, because they keep going back over and over to the emergency department. And what we realized is that we had over 2,400 visits related to behavioral health in the emergency department in 1 year, and those totaled just about $23 million in charges. And we didn't even have a behavioral health provider in the emergency department. So those people were not getting their needs adequately met. And we also found that we had high utilizers, people who use the emergency department over and over five times in a year. Some people used it 10 times. Some people used it over 15. There were 305 of those high utilizers, and they had disproportionately high charges in the emergency department. So we realized we needed to look at the full behavioral health system. So the second report really looks at what we have in our community to help support people with substance use disorders and mental health issues. And we looked at the SAMHSA continuum of care. SAMHSA is Substance Abuse Services Administration. And we identified some real gaps. And what was really interesting was a lot of the state funding was going towards serving people with serious emotional disorders or serious mental illness, and it wasn't going upstream to try and work with people with just mild to moderate problems. So those, a lot of times if you don't focus early, then you get to have more severe problems. So that was a big finding. We also found that as a borough, we were disproportionate, not receiving the proportionate amount of funds we should be from the state. There were other areas that were much more heavily funded than MATSU, and we have one of the fastest growing populations in the state. So those were the main findings, and it really gives us a place to work with our community and with the Division of Behavioral Health to try and figure out how to fill in those gaps in our continuum of care. So this third report now hopefully goes even farther upstream and looks at prevention. How do we prevent these behavioral health problems in the first place?
Let me take just a second, remind listeners you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Today we're talking with representatives of the MATSU Health Foundation about a recent report addressing child maltreatment and prevention. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us in the next 45 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and a toll-free number if you need it, 1-888-353-5752. So what I heard you say is you identified that resources were not being used appropriately or as efficiently. You weren't getting your fair share of the funds, and you realized that you needed data to drive change, which still escapes some people, and things can start out not such a big problem and get worse, and so prevention often is cheaper and certainly more effective than treatment.
You just summed it up. Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is not new information. It makes a lot of sense. A lot of people start with a little anxiety and end up with significant depression and then make attempt suicide because of the depression. Just to give you an example of how things can get started as a pediatrician, seeing stuff like that happen. Amy, so what are your thoughts about where we're going, and then what are you doing specifically in your program area?
Yeah, so what's great about the report in our work in the Healthy Foundations for Families focus area is not only looking at how we're supporting children, but equally how we are supporting the parents or the guardians and the caretakers of our children, so that we're really looking at equity of resources, of skills and education, and just overall support that the entire community can give to healthy adults, so that we can promote these healthy, nurturing environments that the children are being raised up in. And so we really want to focus on that it takes everyone in our MATSU community to support the children and the parents. So when we say we want to support our children, always want to add and the parents or the guardians and the families and caretakers of that. And so it's really a two-generation approach in how we help ensure that children and parents' needs are met, and that we can do a lot in our grant making and how we have relationships with all the partners in our borough, that we are looking at creating safe, connected, and resilient families. And so the BHES, as we call it, the Behavioral Health Environmental Scan, and this is the third report of that series, has organized itself around the Strengthening Families framework. And that comes from the Center for the Study of Social Policy. And it's a nationally and internationally recognized evidence-based program about parenting and strengthening families. So that is supported by the state of Alaska, actually, and it's been growing and adapted for rural communities, other regions in our state. And it really looks at five main protective factors for how we can support our families, and that is what comprises the framework of it. And so our report and our recommendations from it are organized around those protective factors, again, coming back to the fact that we not only are focusing on supporting our children and preventing maltreatment, and it's going to the parents and the caretakers and the whole system. And what is that system?
I'd like to, we have a phone call, and I'm going to take Tim's phone call, but then I want to get back to this report and the protective factors a little bit more and some of the recommendations that have come out of that. So, Tim, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
This is Jim in Wasilla.
Oh, Jim, sorry. Yes, please.
I can bear with that. My childhood was in the 50s, and back in the 50s, foster homes were called welfare homes. And they've certainly made some improvements in what I experienced, but I was in 13 welfare homes, and along with that, 13 different schools. So by the time I went from one school to the next, I would get myself up to maybe a C plus in my grades. By the time I'd been there a year, 18 months or so, and then it was off to another welfare home, another school, and I was a D minus. So I just went on and on like that. So that was very stressful. And then the other thing is, when you go into a new welfare or foster home, doesn't make any difference. After about the first 3 days, you find out that you're somebody else's dog. And that's the way it goes from that point on. And this is a fact of life. And then the other big lesson I learned, and I realize this as an adult, listening to a psychologist talk about child abuse. And what she said was that once you introduce a child or anybody at any age to shame, and especially a child, it will stay with them a lifetime. And so you get shamed in the welfare home, you get shamed at school, definitely going to get shamed at school for being that welfare kid, because people point that out. So my conclusion to all of this is, don't keep moving kids from one place to another. We would be much better off if we had orphanages and monitored them, group homes, call it what you want, but moving from one place to the other, the shock and the trauma that it brings up lives with you for the rest of your life, and that's how your relationships are going to be. And then when you have issues in life, issues on the job, people say, well, just don't let it bother you. And if you use common sense, and that's why those two phrases right there that hackles me up, because people are not using wisdom and good judgment when they make those kind of comments to people. And the impact that the human voice and words have on a person who's having difficulties in life. And that's why they turn to drugs. Fortunately, I dodged the hippie generation then, because I knew they weren't going to put food on my table, because I spent most of my life hungry when I was a kid. Fact of life. So I have a lot of issues with the system the way it is. It's not perfect, but that needs to be looked at, why we have kids being bounced from one place to another. And I know kids can be difficult, but leave them in one spot, whatever it takes.
Jim, you have a number of excellent you have a number of unfortunate past experiences and a number of excellent points that you've made. And so I'm going to go ahead and we'll try to ask our guests for some comments about these. And then it gives me a chance to talk about why physically, and I mean down to our brain level, if it doesn't come up, why these early experiences can cause lifelong concerns. So I appreciate your call. It's a very appropriate one, and I can assure you that's part of what the Matsu Foundation is trying to address is a lot of what your experience has been in trying to prevent those situations. So thanks for your call. All right. What do you think about Jim's comments?
I think it brings in everything that we're trying to do. I mean, he identified how important his experiences were in his early life to, you know, even what he's experiencing now as an adult. And there's been this research that's really coming to light in the last couple of years, although it was done 15 years ago, and it's about adverse childhood experiences and just how important and how impactful trauma is to kids. And what he described, being moved from, I mean, I assume that there was probably some incident of trauma to get him into the foster care system, but then being moved from place to place is also traumatic. And basically that research shows that, you know, that physical, sexual, and verbal abuse, but also the environment you're in, the household you're in, whether you have alcohol or substance abuse, a parent who's incarcerated, a parent who's died, all these affect a child, and they actually affect their brain development, and they affect their ability to be able to learn. There's the good side is that there's things that can be done to address that and improve their resilience, their ability to bounce back from things like this. But what he described is just textbook for having trauma in early life and then having it affect you throughout your life. And that's what that research showed, is that, you know, if you have that trauma, you're more likely to have substance abuse disorders, to be depressed, to have physical some physical illnesses later in life. That doesn't happen to everybody, but it's a trend that happens with kids who experience this. And so Amy's going to talk a little bit about what's going on to try and work on the specific issues he's talking about with the child welfare system.
One thing I like to do is talk about, because, you know, listeners can hear this and say, oh, yeah, how is it that things that happen early in life can have lifelong consequences? And so I've got a story or a way of explaining that I use with patients almost on a daily basis. So I'm going to take a second, and I'm more than happy for you guys to edit this and change it. But the way I start is helping parents understand that you get about 80% of your adult head size in the first 2 to 3 years of life. And the reason your brain is growing so fast, so quickly, is not because we get more neurons, not because the neurons, those brain cells are getting bigger. It's because with stimulation, they begin to send out branches called dendrites, which talk to other neurons and set up physical circuits. So there's a physical laying down of things. And in fact, if a baby can't see at birth, there's a critical period of time to recognize seeing or hearing deficits. And if you don't fix that, then the brain, your body says, well, I'm going to just get rid of these neurons designed to help me see and hear, because it's a waste of energy. And we lose that opportunity. And no matter what we do later, we're never going to get that back. So the brain, if you start thinking about it hard, is really an excellent learning organ. It can learn. What it can't do, because it's physically, you know, has these circuits, is it can't unlearn. And I use the analogy I stole from somebody. Once you learn how to ride a bike, you can't look at me and tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike, or how to unlearn how to write or something. You take damage to your brain. Now you go back and say, what experiences I have in those first 3 years, how people interact, do I get my needs met physically, am I hit, do I have fear every day? Those things begin to set up circuits about our experiences, which in one way of thinking about it is almost like you set kids up in the right situation for a post-traumatic stress syndrome for the rest of their life. Their whole fight and flight response is changed. They're different. So that's how things early in life can cause lifetime consequences. Does that make sense? Is that similar to what you all think?
They can, yeah. No, totally.
Well, I think that
there are definitely things that can happen in a child's life that can help repair that and that can
help. Yeah. It's not, so it's not laid down forever, but it's like my eating habits. If I'm going to change my eating, I got to set up a new circuit. My old circuit's always going to be there. That's why it's so hard to change that. Explain that kind of thing. But it does get back to the idea that prevention makes a lot more trouble sense than prevention, because it's much, much harder to change these ingrained circuits of behavior that have their origins early in life. Amy, I see you shaking your head up, right? I'm going to talk with you because Melissa's giving me a hard time.
Well, one thing I like to think about with this is the power of relationships and that neuroplasticity that we have. And if it's relationships with caregivers, professional or family members, extended family members, that makes all the difference. That is prevention, not just for the children, but for parents to be able to have supportive social connections and relationships. And that, by helping, you know, having those reinforcements, helps us throughout our lives. And so one of the things that's happening out in the Matsu that is very encouraging and exciting, that is about permanency and placement for children and allowing for consistent, stable relationships to be built, is what's known as a safe babies court or therapeutic family court. Now, the Matsu Health Foundation supports Rock Matsu, Raising Our Children with Kindness, which is a cross-sector collaborative of partners and agencies, individuals around the borough. And it's all to promote family resilience and reduce child maltreatment. And so we could talk more about Rock at any point here, but the main thing I want to share right now is with the Safe Babies Court, which is a collaboration with the Palmer Superior Court, and that is to develop and then implementing as of July 1, actually, a therapeutic court for families with children 3 and young under who are facing out-of-home placement for whatever reasons. So really, in that first month of life, if a child might have to be taken out of custody, what can we do to help support a team approach in meeting the needs of the families served by this particular court, so that all the professionals will meet regularly, they'll look at the progress of achieving reunification with the family or at least some sort of permanent placement, so that that child with the attachment that is so key at those early days and years of the life. And I think back to our caller, Jim, and I want to thank him so much for sharing his life experience with us and what that's meant, because if we can help ward off numerous placements and start from day one that it's needed in that young life, the lifetime impacts for that person and overall the systems of care will be tremendous. And so, as I mentioned, with this particular court happening in the Matsu with Palmer Superior Court, that will begin serving families come July 1. And we have a coordinator that's been hired, and it's been dedicated. There's a multi-year plan for this. And we're really excited by the potential that this will have with the permanency of young ones.
So what I hear you saying is you've taken the science, the evidence, and brought it into the court system to be sure they're aware of the consequences of the decisions they make. Is that not quite right?
I'm sure that's a part of it.
I mean, you're trying to encourage not having people move around all over, all kids like Jim's experience, because we know that that decreases the likelihood of healthy outcomes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you can't, but the more we build up resilience, the more we decrease the bad experiences, the better the likelihood of a healthier outcome.
I think another key part of the Safe Babies Court is really getting all different sectors that are involved in this system. So Office of Children's Services, the court system, whoever the Office of Children's Services is requiring the parents to go get, say, substance abuse treatment from or mental health counseling. They're trying to coordinate all these systems because a lot of times the judge might recommend one thing for sentencing or, you know, to move this case forward, but there's no access to that service in the community or people don't know where to go for that. So this is really advantageous because it has a whole team of people working on getting, you know, either getting that reunification to happen or getting permanent placement to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is gratifying to hear courts, the legal system, to begin and to be more aware of more evidence-based models for a lot of our behavioral problems that humans are having.
And Melissa, isn't it true that the court system was so invigorated by the community coming to them saying, we want to help our families here? Right. And it was really like, we have this intense need, and this is going to really help. So we are on board. And it really got fired up. Is that right?
Right, it did. And Judge White out there is a real champion for this, and she's really been helping to move it forward.
We're going to have to take a short break. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. If you've got questions or comments, we're going to be here another almost 25 to 27 minutes talking about what the Mat-Su Health Foundation is doing for residents of the Mat-Su borough. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be gone for just about 1 minute, and then we'll return and talk with Amy Gorin and Dr. Melissa Kimberling. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Dr. Melissa Kimberling. She's the Director of Programs for the Mat-Su Health Foundation, and also joining us at the last minute was Amy Gorin. Amy is the Program Officer for the Healthy Foundations for Families focus area with the Mat-Su Foundation. The foundation has been working to improve the health of residents in the Mat-Su borough, and we're discussing one of their focus areas in particular, preventing child maltreatment. In addition, we've talked about some results of some extensive research demonstrating that lifelong consequences of many children which experience adverse exposures, like exposure to parents with mental illness or substance abuse, a parental separation and divorce, physical abuse, and household members having spent time in incarcerated can all have lifelong experiences or consequences of that, those exposures. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or toll-free at 1-888-353-57 to make comments or ask questions. Please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions. We have a couple of calls, but before we get to those calls, one of the things that Dr. Kimberling wanted to make sure we discuss is the way we look at prevention, primary, secondary, and maybe tertiary prevention, and what are meant by those terms and why is it important to you?
Sure. So this is a model usually used with disease and in public health, but I think it really applies to this child maltreatment as well. And so basically we look at this as working at three different levels. So primary prevention is way upstream. It's trying to prevent problems from happening in the first place. So it's supporting all children and families, those who are having good times, but they might not be around, family relatives that can help with raising their kids, new parents who need more information maybe on, you know, what to do in the first year of life. That's primary prevention. It's for all families and all children. Secondary prevention focuses on families who are having stress. So we know that when families are undergoing stress, whether it's economic or maybe someone returning from the military with PTSD or whatever type of stress, it can affect the how well parents parent, you know, because they're undergoing a lot of stress. And it can also affect just the environment, can affect the children. So that's secondary prevention, to really go in and help those families before anything bad happens as far as child maltreatment, and help them with what they're dealing with. And then the third is tertiary prevention, which is helping families who already have experienced adverse childhood experiences in their household or with their kids, and even homeless youth who are out and, you know, they don't have a family, but they're young adults who are trying to make their way in the world. So those are the three levels of prevention. And I think just like any type of healthcare, you know, the fire gets put out. So if there's a crisis, that's where a lot of our funds go. So primary prevention doesn't get a lot of funding, but it could really be economically a good decision in the long run, because you could avert a lot of those crises later on if you're focusing on supporting all families and children.
Before I open up the questions, there's three phone calls that are here. Was there anything else we needed to make sure we address? Because once I get into the phone call, sometimes it's a little hard to get back on track. There is one thing I know I want to ask, but Amy, was there anything you had?
Not at this time, but just to add that the key recommendations from the report that we're here talking about, as I mentioned, they're focused around the protective factors of that strengthening families framework. And it's really neat because the recommendations have been essentially labeled as primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. Mm-hmm. And so it really breaks out some specifics in how we can think about and approach this community-wide through the things put forth. So if we get time later, we can.
Why don't you go ahead? That's what I thought there was something. You wanted to mention the five protective factors were, I think, really important, and then those lead to a series of recommendations, and then we'll get into the questions.
All right. Be sure to jump in if I get too wordy here. So the first one is just knowledge of parenting and child development. And this just ensures that parents, guardians, child caregivers, we have the information on child development when we need to have it, and that it is accurate, so that we can look at children's behaviors based on their age. We know what healthy child development is. We know things about developing brains, needing proper nutrition and regular sleep, physical education, many of those things. And a lot of our recommendations fall into this primary prevention area that Melissa was just sharing. And it's an area that we often don't see the most dollars going to support. And so one of those could be supporting the development of parent training classes, a whole array of them, support groups perhaps, and other initiatives to just educate all parents on what is child development and appropriate parenting skills. And that can get really specific if we want to help prepare all pregnant women for what will happen during the first year of that baby's life, and where to get information or connect to techniques. We want to ensure that parenting classes and support groups are available to all parents, as well as those who are in crisis or at risk for crisis. Another one is parental resilience, that parents are resilient when they're able to handle personal challenges and those of their children. So we might want to look at supporting the whole parent and child in medical settings with physical and behavioral health care, trauma-informed practices and policies, universal screenings for trauma, and referral for social service needs. The third protective factor in this framework is social connections. So again, that parents need people who care for them and their children and can be good listeners. You know, are we turning to our neighbors? Are we asking for help when we need to reach out or feel stressed in times? How connected do we feel? And what is our community doing to build supportive relationships among residents and families and seniors and parents? So are we doing some things for community gathering spaces or developing hubs to find out where I can get my child involved in activities or where I can volunteer? Another protective factor is social and emotional competence of children. So we know when a young child has positive interactions with others and is able to self-regulate behaviors in the school system, out in the world, with families, with their feelings, that this all has a positive impact on the relationships that they're building and how well they're able to learn in school. And so what are we doing with our school environments to help that in curriculum? And how can we encourage social emotional learning for homeschool children and even do this in aftercare settings so that, again, those children feel connected with their communities? And then the final protective factor in this framework that we've organized our recommendations around is concrete support in times of need. So families' basic needs must be met. This really gets into some of the more tertiary types of prevention, you know, putting out those fires, making sure that we are taking care of each other's basic needs. And you know, there are other system-related recommendations related to that. So a lot of it is focused in primary prevention, which is, again, where we feel this is pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, it all makes a lot of sense if you really get into the understanding. I think you guys have done a wonderful job. But I have a couple phone calls I need to address here. Kelly, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. This kind of goes back before the when you were talking about the court system. And my thought was that that's all well and good, that by the time somebody is in the court system, actually in the courtroom, it's like the pimple that's come to the head. It's been an issue for quite some time. And now I understand that's probably your tertiary. But my question is how does a person without have a clue of where even to get started on all these little programs you have? And then it occurred to me, perhaps somebody that was, you're describing somebody that in my mind is on public assistance quite often, is on public assistance. And so it could taking classes in parenting, nutrition, finances, self-worth, all that good stuff that people are lacking that gets themselves in these horrible situations, were raised in many cases in these horrible situations and are raising another generation in these horrible situations of basic ignorance, could their public assistance monies and programs be tied to them attending these classes, or am I out of line here?
I would make the comment that I don't think you're out of line, but I would comment from my experience is that socioeconomic factors are not necessarily the issue here. These issues happen regardless of socioeconomic, and people with poor socioeconomic situations can be great parents. And the opposite is also true. So I'm not trying to be entirely critical, more to point out that that's my experience, and that, but it does get down to how do we use the money, where does the money go, who's at the greatest need, how do we identify those individuals, particularly from a prevention standpoint, which makes so much sense to me. And which, in general, we're not doing in this country. Melissa, do you have any other comments for Kelly's?
Yeah, I would agree with what you said about it's not exclusive to low-income people. And I think that's where we get back to primary prevention. I think that everybody can benefit from it, what the caller mentioned, you know, all of those classes. But I think it's also, it gets back to what Amy was saying about it's really the community. The whole community
right.
has to be
right.
involved.
Right.
So it's childcare providers, it's employers, it's medical providers, it's schools. It's churches,
yep.
it's you and I, it's volunteers, it's everybody.
Sure.
So if we can work to create a tight-knit community, there's three things we need. A tight-knit community, we need everyone to have a certain level of knowledge about ACEs, about child development and parenting, and we need our systems to change, policies and procedures to help, to be focused on helping and supporting these families and not blaming them. And then we need the services. When people are having a hard time, we need to make sure we have the programs and services that can address that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Carolyn, you're on line one.
Yes, good afternoon. A few things real fast. Number one, we talk about the cost of things, but we don't talk about the opportunity costs. What are we missing when we don't take care of the people who are being abused and given an opportunity to become the person they could be if that hadn't happened? Also, this has not happened in the last 50 years. This is a problem that's been going on for decades, and it's going to take us a long time to fix it. It's not going to be something that will be completed by the next budget cycle. And I think people lose sight of the fact that it's going to take time. Also, real quickly on the home ec, I'm 73 now, and home ec was taught in high school, but only the girls had to take it. I think there are aspects, and in time, I think our young people would see the importance of family if we're teaching in mass how to budget for a family, you know, high schoolers. But one question I wanted to find out is if it's still going on. In Hawaii, I heard about a program that was called the Grandmothers. And, of course, these women had to be vetted, but they were available to help families that had new babies. If the family wanted help, the woman would come over and basically as a counselor, a family counselor, because they'd been through it. And we have so few people up here that have an extended family, and I'm sure the same thing is in Hawaii. So those are just the things that top of mind, but again, what are the opportunity costs?
Very good point, and a couple of good points. Comments from our guests?
We totally agree mm-hmm. with her. And, you know, we are looking for programs like that to come into the borough. In fact, there's a really interesting one that we have, which is Beacon Hill Safe Families, that tries to act before the Office of Children Support is involved. And they have churches involved that they will take care of the children in the family if the parents are in a crisis. So that kind of is trying to step in and prevent, you know, these very expensive and traumatic situations from happening later on. So, yeah, I think that's an exciting program that she's talking about, too. Mm-hmm.
It dawned on me, I think there is a broader perspective, too, is it, we're always can be better. I mean, but I think socially as well as economically, we're all better off than we were in the 1700s and the 1800s. Mm-hmm. But we still got ways to go to make things even better for everybody, and to control some of our social ills, which are leading to poor health, is one of the important points to keep in mind too. Here, we can still do a lot. All right, Thomas, you're on line one.
Well, one thing I heard that if you don't hold your baby enough during the first 2 years, the frontal lobes don't grow properly. But what my call was really about was about nutrition. I got adopted by a free-range Inupiaq boy. Their family was living in a hotel and bed bugs and bad food, and he would hit uncontrollably. And related to me, a video I saw about kids that won't eat nothing but chicken nuggets and french fries, and we can't get them to eat anything. But it wasn't that he wouldn't eat anything. It's just they didn't have a kitchen and Pepsi and potato chips. That was his meal, it seemed to me. And when I fed him well, the hitting, the bad behavior went away. And when he gets hungry over a prolonged period of time, bad nutrition, the behavioral problems come back up. And I don't think that they can control those kind of things, because the brain is not operating functional, or you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it is as we described earlier. It may have learned certain behavioral modifications. It doesn't mean that it can't be changed. I certainly don't want anybody to hear that, but it is much harder to change because there's this bedrock system that's already been grooved there, and it gets back to this prevention is much turns out probably much less expensive and certainly much more effective than our current approach to try to change people when they're teenagers or adults.
Well, and another thing I'd like to bring up is the music that young people listen to, such as his favorites, Kodak Black, and it's it's nothing like we ever listened to, I'll tell you that. Hard,
right.
You know, you put adult permission on the label that, you know, you got to have your parents' permission to buy it, but you don't. You just download it, and they're all listening to it, and it's all just real violent music.
Yeah, I'm not personally good enough to explain the psychology of that, but I suspect there might be some relationships to their early upbringing. I agree.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're listening to Kill, Kill, Kill all the time, it makes it pretty easy, I think. So I think there's the music culture is a big effect for those that are, that's what they listen to. Anyway,
yep.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call very much, Thomas. It's hard to say in situations like that which is the chicken and which is the egg. I have a feeling that the music is just the consequence of some of the or preferences. But again, I'm not an expert in that area. One thing I would like to point out to listeners, if they really are interested in learning a little bit more about what we're talking about, we have some web resources on our webpage. You go to alaskapublic.org, hit the Line 1 link. You'll easily find today's program. The Matsu Foundation is linked there. The CDC website's on violence prevention, child maltreatment, as well as the ACEs information, which we've discussed. And that is not one study. It's a number of different studies that have all found similar situations. And I always find it interesting to recognize that the original ACEs study was looking at obesity as an outcome. And that's when they recognized that early childhood experiences could affect our eating habits and the likelihood of obesity. And that's where all this kind of got started. And I think it's kind of interesting to make that association. And two more things on our website, which I think are maybe interesting if you particularly want to know more. There's a link to five videos that come out of the University of Minnesota Center for Early Education and Development that talk about child development early in life in a little bit greater detail. There are five videos, about 3 to 5, 7 minutes in length. And then I also had given to me by a speech therapist here in Anchorage who I see their children. And I've talked the talk I gave to a little earlier about brain development. And she sent me a link about a man trying to learn how to ride a bike that when you turn it right, it goes left to demonstrate how hard it is to change learned behaviors. And it's a fun and very well done video. There's a link also on our website. So, Melissa, enough of that. One of the problems with change like we're talking about with behaviors and outcomes is it takes a long time to see results. And most of the time, funding agencies, politicians, they need to see change pretty quickly. So what strikes me is advantageous is your setup where you got a stream of income coming and you can stick with this long enough to really demonstrate some significant changes over time, because you've got that you don't have that short-term perspective that is almost inherent in everything we do in the United States, unfortunately.
Right. Now, that's a huge advantage we have. And really, it's how we operate. We try and do a pilot project and really measure the results, show the cost savings, and then try and change the system, you know, so get, you know, different third-party reimbursers to pay for the service or whatever. I think that we're in a really very privileged place in that sense.
What's next? You guys, I think it's very, very gratifying for me to see what you're doing. What's next? What are your barriers? Where have been the problems? Anything you want to share with us in that regard?
Well, one of the most immediate things is we have discovery grants at the foundation. So we have two cycles in the year for large grants, $15,000 and above. And so I believe it's May 27th where the pitch is open for discovery grants. So any organization, nonprofit, can go through our report and look at find a recommendation or a finding and propose a program or a service or an enhancement of their services. And we'll consider it for funding. So that's we're really
excited. You have to be in the Matsu Borough.
You have to be in the Matsu Borough, or you have to be providing services in the Matsu Borough, basically.
Okay.
Yep. And we actually have a number of ongoing programs right now that we've funded that really promote a lot of the recommendations that are in our report. We have ACE interface trainers that go out throughout the borough. They're part of the ROC program. And they can train any organization on adverse childhood experiences and resilience. And in fact, we did a household survey just last year, and it showed that 41% of our adults are familiar with the term adverse childhood experiences. Mm. So we're really trying to create that knowledge borough-wide.
And those trainers of it will speak to anyone if they want to come to a book club or to a church or a whole entire organization, no matter the size group of people, they want to get people talking and understanding and learning about this. So a lot of deployment with that.
Yeah. And another exciting thing is that the Matanuska-Susitna School District is really on board with social-emotional learning. And historically, our Healthy Schools grants has gone to support curriculum and these efforts. But one of the challenges that we're facing now is the cut in funding for schools. And so we're going to have larger class sizes. So that's going to present a challenge as far as the social-emotional competency of the kids in such a large learning environment. So we're a little bit nervous about that. We have a Head Start program out there that is becoming what's called Trauma Smart. So they're catering what they do to working with families who have experienced adverse childhood experiences or just the parents who may have had that in their history. So that's really exciting. And they're spreading the word about ACEs and resilience. So there's a number of really exciting things going on out in the borough now.
We are in our last 2 minutes, and I have another question, but I think it's better perhaps to let you all sum up what you want our listening audience to take away from this program.
Well, thanks a lot for having us here to get to talk about this report, because it really just captures our approach of wanting to support the whole system and community of families and our parents and the caregivers. And so whether you're in the MATSU or not, I think this report has a lot of great information, and its whole just structure is something that people can take away from. Again, the data is MATSU specific. I think the approach of this and with the prevention aspect is really important. So please do go online and feel free to check it out and use it.
Melissa, any final comments?
No, just thank you for having us on the show.
Oh, thank you for all that you all are doing. So my thanks to Amy Gorn and Dr. Melissa Kimberling for joining us on this program today. If you want to continue this discussion on child maltreatment and adverse experiences, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our Line 1 archives, and you can listen to previous programs or encourage someone to listen to this program at another time that might be more convenient for themselves. Next week, Line 1 continues, and my co-host, Prentice Pimperton, is going to be discussing with Julie Vincic of the Alaska Anchorage School District adolescent suicide and what they're doing to help prevent adolescent suicide. And in addition, they're also going to discuss a recent Netflix series that has gotten quite a bit of publicity called 13 Reasons Why. Why not join him and Julie on the next Line 1, Monday, May 15th at 2 p.m. It repeats that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. I want to thank Dave Waldron, who engineered today's program, and Eric Bork, who is the Line 1 editor on the website. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.